I was so ready. I had spent the last 2.5 years acquiring knowledge for my PhD. 2.5 years of unlearning so much of what had informed me. I had read and studied so many research articles. I knew the statistics of the marginalized and underrepresented groups. I even had conceptualized the line of research for my dissertation on cross-cultural mentoring. I went so far as reformatting one of my classes I was teaching to include a couple days worth of conversation on cross-cultural competence and the role it had to play in the sports medicine field. So when the day finally arrived, I went in with this mindset feeling like I was going to create this environment for a new frontier of awareness. Minds blown, eyes open, definitely full of humility, wasn't I? At one point during the class, I took one of those dramatic pauses after dropping a knowledge bomb on them. And then, after a moment of silence or two, I asked them what they were thinking, what they were feeling, if they had anything to share. One of the girls in the class raised her hand and asked to share something. And I was so ready to hear about what this newfound awareness was doing inside her. But what followed was something that I will have never forgotten. She told the story of where she came from, that all she knew of her story, or of what she could at least piece together, was that she was found on the side of the road in a shoebox, taken in and raised eventually by a couple that was white, which she was not, and that all through her life, up until this point, she had never been able to identify her ethnic origin. And while the rest of the details of the story at that moment have become a bit fuzzy for me, what she said at the end is what has stuck with me. You see, she asked if any one of us in the class that day knew what it was like to have to check the box marked other. How hard it has always felt for her to find her fit, to feel like she belonged. It was a powerful moment. Powerful because other went from a category and statistic in my head to a human face right in front of me, created by God, just like I was. I had seen her, taught her, but what I came to find out that day is that I did not know her. Gang, what would it take to get to know the story behind the face, underneath the category or statistic? What if we got to know others and let them know us? What would it take? What would it look like? Maybe the bigger question to start with is, why aren't we? On the surface, it's easy to blame the world. I mean, just look at the current landscape we live in. Everywhere you look, there is hostility and divisiveness, battle over borders and what to do with immigrants and refugees and safe cities. Terms like gaslighting, redlining, and gerrymandering make you turn a certain shade of blue or red. I mean, Christians in blue states are moving to states that are red so that they are surrounded with people who share similar values. I mean, let's face it, there is a psychological ease in being surrounded by similar people. But there's also the simple truth that it's just easier to hide behind the pace and priorities of life. I mean, how can you and I possibly do anything more than we're already doing? Job, home stuff, kids' activities. There's that vacation you're saving for. The dog needs walk twice a day. You got to get that workout in. You got to binge watch that series or take on one more client. Then there's that paper that needs written, that TikTok video to make or remake and remake again because it's just still not right. And the list goes on and on and on. So how could you possibly find time to get to know other? To sit down and finally see someone who doesn't look like you, think like you, identify you as you, or grew up like you did. How has this become our narrative, gang? As John Tyson puts it in his book, said it often comes down to one word, fear. Fear of other, fear of change, loss, fear of the unknown. The same fears that cause us to prioritize our lives over others. When I first read that, I bristled a bit, as I'm certain some of you just did. But think about it. We like safe. We like predictable. We like comfort. And most of us certainly don't like change. And there is a certain level of comfort and safety when we are surrounded by people that look like us, think like us, act like us, and share the same values. But we are in a time, gang, right now where we are faced with social change at a dizzying rate. With the arrival of the internet, the ease of travel, social media that connects us around the world, diversity of college campuses, it has ushered in a new generation that values diversity and difference over sameness. And it's at each of our doorsteps. And I'm going to poke a bit more. You see, because for most of us, if we're really being honest, different is seen as a threat to the status quo. And it's hardwired deep within you and me that when the status quo is threatened, our natural human response is one of anxiety and fear. And there is a historical precedent to be mindful of. But before we get there, I think it's important, and this is a good spot to get a working definition of the other. You see, the other is an individual who is perceived by the majority group as not belonging, as being different in some fundamental way. Other lacks an essential characteristic possessed by the dominant group. And as a result, the other is almost always seen as a lesser or inferior. The other in a society may have few or no legal rights, may be characterized as less intelligent or immoral, and may even be regarded as subhuman. Otherness takes many forms. The other may be someone who is of a different race, nationality, religion, social class, political ideology, sexual orientation, place of origin, or a different intellectual or physical ability. And desirable and undesirable nuances exist as well. Our society values the exotic other, someone who looks different but is socially approved because of some characteristic. Australians or Brits or Scots have cool accents and come from desired places to visit and are rarely seen as immigrants in the same way those from Muslim or Central American countries are. Whether you care to admit it or not, the undesirable are often kept at a distance. And that's a huge problem. Because the more you and I distance ourselves from them, the less we feel connected. And the less we feel connected to that person, the less responsibility we feel to care for that person. And what results is what theologian Miroslav Volf has termed the persistent practice of exclusion. You see, instead of inviting others in, you and I push them to the boundaries of our minds, hearts, and lives. Rather than being seen as a gift, they are easier to be seen as a threat to the security and the sameness of our lives. Sadly, we have a storied history of practicing exclusion. Andrew Shepherd, a teacher of theology and ethics, says it this way: other is either to be explicitly feared, a potential terrorist coming to destroy civilization and our place in it, or is simply another abstract commodity, at best to be tolerated, or at worst, competing for limited resources, one to be struggled against. And this fear plays out over a four-stage process. Here's what the research has found. First, we seek to eliminate. We eliminated unwanted others from our circle, typically through legislation or violence. There's plenty of historical moments in our world, think genocide, ethnic cleansing, Nazi Germany, and our country has its own version on this one, whether it be the civil rights era or even our current landscape of immigration. Now, if elimination doesn't work and we can't get rid of them, then we seek to assimilate. And the goal here is to make others seem just like us so we no longer have to live with the undesirable difference. Think what the U.S. settlers did with the Native Americans, or the thoughts we don't say out loud when we hear people speak a different language other than English in our country. If that doesn't work, we ramp it up and seek to dominate. The objective here is an attempt to normalize our standards and penalize them for any variance or deviation from our defined norms. This can come in many forms: economic, political, legislative, educational, or even psychological. Act like this, talk like that, dress like this, standardize test this. And if that doesn't work, we turn to the last one, and that is demonizing others. We demonize others by removing their humanity to justify any behavior, one we saw play out not so long ago in our election cycles. You see, at the core of it, categorizing people as other has a profound impact on our capacity to love, doesn't it? And hear me on this, gang. When we as the church categorize image bearers of God, we in turn bear no resemblance to Jesus at all. You see, Jesus defied social categories. I'm pretty sure Jesus never said, fear one another. He said, love one another. What if we ran towards rather than away from those who were different than us? Not to erase the difference, but to embrace it. To create a space where division no longer had a space. Where we replaced isolation and exclusion with inclusion and belonging. Where fear of other might be the next big thing that we add to the cancer culture movement. You see, that's what Jesus did. And he did it in the most simple of ways. And it centered around one word: hospitality. And for Jesus, hospitality was not one of his many strategies to choose from. It was the strategy. It permeated from his pores. Every interaction was a hospitable moment, and it led to this beautiful mosaic of understanding and inclusion that took the most culturally incompatible backgrounds and formed them into a new community. A community that exchanged fear of other for love one another. Which brings us to our big idea today. You see, hospitality resists fear. So let's start with the definition of hospitality. Hospitality comes from the Greek word philoxenia. A quick word study on this showcases the deep meaning of this word. For most of us, we look at hospitality as an act of showing someone welcome. But in the original Greek, the word carries with it a certain sense of love for the foreigner, where there is this a deep desire embedded in their DNA to invite the foreigner into their life, to stop everything because of the high value they place in creating an environment of welcome. In essence, to make other feel like another one of them. Rather than fear of the other, hospitality is love for the other. This is the way God has loved us. And how quickly we forget what our lives are like before God saved us. Sadly, we project ourselves into the story of salvation in distorted ways, misreading scripture as though we were the insider group. It's this very thing that the Apostle Paul reminds us of in his letter to the Ephesians. Check this out. It says, "Therefore, remember that at one time you Gentiles in the flesh called the uncircumcision by what is called the circumcision, which is made in the flesh by hands. Remember that you were at that time separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ." Paul is quick to point out, hey, don't forget that you are outsiders yourself, aliens, strangers to the covenant of God, excluded. I mean, even for the Israelites, the ones chosen by God, there had to be a constant reminder to Israel that to remember their otherness, like the expulsion from Eden and the great narrative of God welcoming back Israel throughout the Old Testament, how they were wilderness wanderers, how there were foreigners in Egypt before they finally got to the promised land. Fast forward to Jesus' time, the Pharisees were notorious in using boundary markers to exclude and dehumanize. Anything that let people know that there was a clear difference between the Pharisees and those people. Words like unclean, sinner, dog, public shame, lines in the sand. To associate with them was to risk being contaminated. Worse yet, to lose their reputation in the process. For the Pharisees, hospitality, you see, was conditional. And hear this, gang, conditional hospitality will always crystallize borders. Jesus' hospitality, on the other hand, was scandalously unconditional. Which brings us to our passage today found in Luke 7, starting in verse 36. We're going to read it in its entirety, and what I want you to do is to act like you're there. I'm going to read it a bit slower with some added narration. Okay, you ready? Here we go. Picking it up in Luke chapter 7, starting in verse 36. When one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. Now, what a collection, right? All the cool people, scribes, teachers of the law, like the elite of elite. And a woman in that town who lived a sinful life learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house. Now, she totally sticks out, right? Her clothes are ragged, her hair a mess. Everyone notices that she is there, but they ignore her. So she comes forward and she comes with this alabaster jar of perfume. As she stood behind him, at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. And she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, poured perfume on them. Imagine the aroma that filled the room. Now it's awkward. Everyone notices. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." Jesus answered him, "Simon, I have something to tell you." And we all at the table, we lean in, anticipation at a fever pitch. "Tell me, teacher," he said. "Two people owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he forgave the debts of both. Now, which of them will love him more?" Simon replied, "Well, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt forgiven." "You have judged correctly," Jesus said. Then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman, from the time I entered, has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, as her great love has shown. But whoever has been forgiven little loves little. Then Jesus said to her, your sins are forgiven. The other guests began to say among themselves, who is this who even forgives sins? It's a great contrasting picture of two styles of hospitality, isn't it? And I think it also provides us a great lesson for us into the who, how, and why of hospitality. And with our remaining time, that is exactly what we are going to unpack. So let's first dive into the who. Look it again at verse 44. Now, maybe you were wondering like me. Okay, so I know Jesus was invited, but how does the woman even get to the point of being in the house? I mean, there's no way she was invited. You can clearly gather that from the passage and Simon's reaction, right? She was an outcast in his eyes, in the eyes of most everyone else at that dinner party. So here's what I found just a cool thing to note. When a rabbi and teacher was visiting in someone's home, it was an acceptable common practice in that culture for uninvited guests to come and listen to the conversation. Certainly didn't have a place at the table, but most likely it was through an open window or on the outskirts of the space where the dining was occurring, typically a courtyard or open eating area. And wrapped up into this exchange Jesus has with Simon is an action and a key word for us to focus in on as it pertains to hospitality. After Jesus tells the quick story of the moneylender, we pick it back up in verse 44. It reads this. Then turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, do you see this woman? I absolutely love the fact that Jesus turns towards the woman and asks Simon the question, do you see this woman? Oh, the thoughts that must have been flowing from Simon's heart. I mean, come on. If I'm Simon, I'm like, are you kidding me? Who the heck is this guy? Of course I do. Every single person here does. How can you miss her? And we know what Simon was thinking, right? Look at what it says in verse 39. If this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. Dressed like that, smelling like that, the harlot that she is. Everyone knows about her in this village, and now she's completely interrupted my dinner party. She is clearly labeled, categorized, and dehumanized. And it sounds like Simon's true colors are coming out. He's a Pharisee, so we know there is a fear of being made unclean, let alone even talking to her. The Pharisees were known for their conditional hospitality, dining with those that only made them look good. But I wonder what happens when the words Jesus uses changes up a bit. Simon, do you see this blue-blooded liberal? Simon, do you see this transgender person? Simon, do you see this Muslim? Do you see this refugee? This African American, this Asian American, this disabled person, this drunk, this addict, this felon, this Steeler fan? Go Browns. Do you see who you are in this story? Remember, Jesus turned toward the woman, full attention, eyes on her, and then said, do you see this woman? He could have easily said, look at this woman. But I think Jesus chose his words very carefully. Look means to focus your eyes on something. See means to actually perceive it. And it's clear that the only one in that room that wasn't looking at the woman was Jesus, because Jesus actually saw her. Remember, where we see other, God sees another. Jesus was great at humanizing others that were so often dismissed as outsiders. Remember, we were all aliens, sojourners, and yet God in his kindness, love, and grace invited us to his table. If it was good enough for God to do, shouldn't it be good enough for us? Who has God been desperately asking you to see, to extend hospitality to in a way that demonstrates your desire to get to know them as the image bearer they are? Extending an invitation to those who are not like you, expecting nothing in return. And our culture today, a culture of fear and divisiveness, is ripe. May I dare say it's craving for a space of welcome for the stranger, the enemy, the outsider. It's eerily similar to the culture of Jesus's day, where he created something so radically different, a space where there was an open environment of welcome, something he ended up calling the church. Which brings us to the how of hospitality. We must be willing to create an environment of welcome. And to get a picture of that, I think it's good to start with how not to go about doing it. I love the fact that the woman and Jesus were the hospitable ones in the home of Simon. Yes, Simon opened up his home, but that's not the kind of hospitality we learned about earlier, is it? He was just simply demonstrating an act. You see, there's a big difference between opening up your homes and opening up your hearts. This was the fatal flaw of Simon, and it's our big flaw as well, church. We just aren't good anymore at rearranging our lives for someone else, especially when it comes at our inconvenience. Our schedules are too full of our priorities, chasing after our advancements to increase our comforts. I mean, why would we ever arrange for the few to sacrifice what we've got going on? And I know this is where I will lose you, where you will stop short, because this is where I've been lost and have stopped short as well, far too often. You see, because the how of hospitality requires the sacrifice of my time and my vulnerability and demands nothing in return. Fascinatingly enough, I think we can agree that COVID slowed us down, but I don't think we're filling those spaces with the right priorities. I actually think we've insulated ourselves with more of ourselves. If you were to look at your calendar, how much of the activities on it have something to do with you? And for those of us who have kids, I'm going to poke because I know what you're thinking. On the surface, yes, it looks like it's not about you because it's so full of their stuff. But is there margin for the other in your lives? Parents, here's the thing. We can no longer hide behind their activities as our excuse. If we claim that Christ changed our lives, but leave no margin for the other, we are falling short in demonstrating to our kids what it looks like to love one another. In the end, we are just reinforcing our own sinful habits of prioritizing us instead of them into our kids. So yes, our calendars are going to have to look different. Our calendars should have regularly scheduled time, whether it's weekly, monthly, whatever, for fostering hospitality with others, to go out of our way to actually inviting them over for a meal or meeting somewhere for coffee, and then doing it again and again and again. Same person, same place. If you were to actually trace the hospitality of Jesus just through the Gospel of Luke, it's full of Jesus eating with people. Luke chapter 5, 7, 9, 10, 11, 14, 19, 22, 24. Jesus was sharing meals with tax collectors, sinners, Pharisees, teachers of the law, fishermen, the poor, women, friends, enemies. But Jesus went beyond the invite, didn't he? He also was masterful at opening up his heart, and it is simply through getting to know them. Remember, the goal of hospitality is for the guest, the stranger, the foreigner, to feel a sense of love and belonging. We do that by getting to know their story, asking questions, listening, and opening up when they ask us questions. And I get it. You may have to overcome some fear or come face to face with a prejudice about the person you're inviting to share a space with you. But remember, hospitality resists fear. The hospitality demonstrated by Jesus steps into the fear of discomfort and walks towards it. You see, that kind of hospitality is willing to admit and confront some hidden biases and prejudices in your life, whether it has to do with race, gender identity, sexual orientation, political affiliation, ableism, ageism, or any other kind of ism. That kind of hospitality takes the long, windy road. It expects it to be messy because relationships are messy. And the most meaningful ones are the ones that embody sacrifice, intentionality, and vulnerability. You see, that kind of hospitality is willing to see past what your eyes see and see others as God sees. Because that's what Jesus did. And it brings us to our why. You see, we all crave a space where we are welcomed in love for who we are. A space free of judgments. A space where you no longer have to wear the mask anymore or carry around the cardboard cutout of what others expect you to be. To simply be the person that God designed you to be. We as Christians should be great at this because this was the way our gracious God has treated us. By extending to us endless amounts of grace to find rest from the labels and categories this world is so masterful at placing on us. That's what hospitality does. It allows grace to dismantle categories and labels and creates a portal of heaven's welcome for a new identity. Look what it did for the woman in our passage. She came in labeled as unwelcomed, outcast, sinner, and she left redeemed, restored, forgiven, and labeled daughter of the king. I mean, look at Jesus' crew. He had nationalist zealots, tax collectors, cultural traders, Pharisees and fishermen, peasants, women, lepers, and every other you could think of. Each one experiencing a beautiful encounter with the grace of God. And because of Jesus' welcoming hospitality, their old identities were transformed. And the result? A new humanity that changed history forever. And it's our call as Christians to embody the same. So my next steps are pretty straightforward. Ask God the question, who do you want me to see? Who do you know that is different enough from you that you may even feel uncomfortable a bit with that person's difference? I mean, heck, it might even be someone in your own family. So use the environment that Thanksgiving naturally creates as leverage. But set aside the discomfort. Resist the fear of the unknown. And then think about a non-threatening invitation you can offer to know that person better. Maybe it's at your house or out for coffee, or maybe it's something on their turf to make them more comfortable. And then the final step, do it. Do it. Why? Because Jesus established the church to exist not as a haven from the world. And if we continue to sit idle, this world and the forces of darkness will continue to increase hate, spread divisiveness, and instill fear. May I remind us that Jesus established the church as a place of hope for the world. Jesus loved and accepted people for who they really were. And it's time for us to do the same. To open our eyes to see. To open our lives, our homes, our hearts, and our minds in such a way that creates environments of welcome the way Jesus did. Because if God doesn't hold back his grace, then neither should you and I. I like what Hebrews 13:2 says. It says, "Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware." John Tyson puts it this way, "Hospitality is the lens that lets us see through the disguise to Christ himself." So when you hear the command that we have heard so many times, may it ring a little differently in your ears and hearts this morning. These are Jesus' words. Jesus said, "A new commandment I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you also must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." And here's the thing. When you and I embrace the strategy of hospitality with those we have labeled other, our perceptions will begin to shift. We will go from seeing the disguise of other to see beloved another. And when we do that, encounter by encounter, fear will be deconstructed and a renewed humanity will be born. So I find it very fitting that we are going to close our time together with reciting this prayer from Martin Luther, a prayer that captures so much of the posture we need to have when it comes to our place in this world as his disciples. May it renew you, may it strengthen you, and may it remind you that the beautiful resistance this world needs can be found in him. God bless you guys.